This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, very good morning. Boker Tov, Shana Tova. How was your Chag?
Boker Tov, Shana Tova. I hope everybody had a meaningful Chag. Yes, here as usual, eating and lots and lots of shofar blowing, which has now become quite a public thing. They do shofar blowing in the park and shofar blowing in the square for people who want to listen to the shofar without necessarily going to a shul. So I think that that's a nice thing. And surprisingly, a little rain last night, which seems a little early because usually we're expecting the rain after Sukkot or perhaps around the Sukkot time. We're not quite there yet, but it is already the end of September. So I suppose we can expect some rain already now. I'm not quite sure if last night's rain qualifies as the Yore, as the official first rains of the season. We'll have to read the press to see what people speculate about, whether this qualifies or not. In Israel, it's a big thing, given that we don't have rain from approximately April until September. Of course, when that first rain comes, it is a big deal. What I wanted to start the new year with is a little discussion about the 50 most influential Jews, which is a list that is published every year by the Jerusalem Post. And while I don't want to talk about all 50 of the most influential Jews, I would like to just mention the top five names on this list as put forward by the Jerusalem Post, and to ask listeners whether you guys agree that these are really the top five most influential Jews in the world right now. Unsurprisingly, number one, Benjamin Netanyahu. He is apparently the most influential Jew in the world. He has been for some time. I think that those who disagree or dislike him would probably not disagree that he is one of the most, if not the most influential Jews in the world today. The second man on the list came as a little bit of a surprise to me, but when you think about it, there is certain justification, and that is Steve Witkoff, who is the Trump administration's negotiator, who is working right now to try to release our hostages and to bring a ceasefire to Gaza. Steve Witkoff apparently is the second most influential Jew in the world. He's closely followed by Dudi Barnea, who is the chief of the Mossad. And he certainly, I think, is probably underestimated because a lot of the work that he does is, by definition, not public. But he's considered nonetheless to be the third most influential Jew in the world. And he's followed by Chief of General Staff Eyal Zamir. He, of course, is a relatively new chief of general staff, but he has already assumed a very, very important and influential position. And then, interestingly, number five has two names, Steve Miller and Adam Buller, who are White House advisors and who are considered to be very influential in the way that White House policy is devised. And so even though their names might not be those at the top of the headlines all the time, we have seen them in the headlines from time to time, but they are considered to be highly influential because of the fact that they have the president's ear. What do you guys think?
It's fascinating to hear and to think who the most influential are. And it'd be great to hear from you. 0618951019. A number of people were injured yesterday, and some of them seriously on the second day of Rosh Hashanah in Eilat by a Houthi drone that struck the center of the city. So how's it happening that these drones are able to get through?
So there have been a few incidents of drone strikes in Eilat. We've reported on them before, we already know that drones are a slight problem for Israel in terms of the anti-missile system, because the drones are able to be maneuvered and to navigate in ways that are potentially going to avoid Israel's anti-missile system. And by that I mean that if they are, for example, below a certain altitude, then anti-missile systems like Iron Dome can't be effective against them. And that's really where our new laser dome system will hopefully come in and be able to strike these kind of missiles, the drones and others, that they are able to maneuver, and somehow they know where the weak spots are in our missile defense system, and obviously are using that information in order to somehow fly literally below the radar and to somehow strike in the middle of the city. I mean, this is not a military target by any stretch of the imagination. This is a drone that's been flown, as we understand, from Yemen by the Houthis. It's come up all that way up the Red Sea towards the city of Eilat, which of course is Israel's southernmost city and right situated right on the Red Sea. So theoretically, the nearest to send a drone to from Yemen. And this drone literally exploded quite near to a mall that is located in Eilat, right in the middle of the city. And there were a number of people who were injured. The different newspapers are reporting different numbers. So it's very, very difficult for me to give you an exact estimation of precisely how many people were injured. I did see reports that suggested between 5 and 10. I saw one report that said 50 people were injured. So there were certainly civilians who were injured in this particular incident, and we understand that at least two people were quite seriously injured. What exactly that means, also, there's very little information coming out, and there's actually quite a very little information about exactly how this happened, that the anti-missile systems were unable to shoot this down. I think that the strategy is to somehow try to target these drones from further away rather than to allow them to come too near to Israel's shoreline, because once they come nearby and they can fly at lower altitude, they're much, much more difficult to shoot down. But obviously, in this particular case, this drone was not brought down in good time. There is also this massive gulf between the cost of the drone and the explosives that are loaded on it, as opposed to the cost of that missile that has to go out in order to intercept it. Now, I know that we shouldn't really be talking about money when lives are concerned, when we're talking about people's safety, and of course, the Israeli Defense Force and Israeli government take upon themselves a massive responsibility to secure the safety and the lives of Israeli citizens. But there is a discussion to be held about how much more expensive it costs, how much more expensive it is for us to send that anti-missile system out than the cost of sending the drone in the first place. And therein lies something of the story about why the Houthis just continue to send these drones, because the cost of them is pretty minimal. The technology on board is quite amazing, that they can actually hit the center of Eilat all the way from Yemen. And so, we certainly need the new laser dome system to be able to counter this threat.
IDF troops operating in Gaza have been attacked from the Shifa hospital again. What more do we know?
Well, there have been some videos that show attacks being launched against IDF troops who have now, we understand, completely encircled Gaza City and have attacked certain critical locations within the city. There are videos circulating showing IDF tanks in the middle of Gaza City, certain suburbs of the city, and there are videos showing once again that the hospital facility is being used as a terror base in order to try to attack IDF troops. Now, why a hospital would be used is, I think, pretty clear to many of us, those at least who wish to believe the narrative. And the reason that a hospital is used is because when the IDF then retaliate and fire missiles towards the hospital where the terrorists are firing towards our troops, then of course this gets held up in the international community as an example of Israel attacking humanitarian sites, attacking medical facilities. This is completely contrary to the Geneva Convention and to many other international conventions. And of course, Israel then gets held up to account and held up to dry by the international community for daring to carry out attacks against a medical facility and Shifa Hospital in particular. But the truth of the matter is that Israel doesn't just do this because it wants to attack the hospital facility. Unfortunately, this is a facility that's being used for terror purposes and for military purposes. And therefore, according to the same Geneva Convention, it becomes a legitimate target. Unfortunately, some of that gets lost in translation when Israel gets held to account. And, you know, there are some quite ironic things that happen about these lies that get propagated over and over and over again. And it doesn't matter that you bring evidence of the fact
because they
that
choose
the
not
lie
to.
Is,
it's simple. Yeah, it's they just choose not to.
It's just crazy how people are unashamed to wheel out information and evidence that's completely, completely inaccurate, and that it doesn't stand up to scrutiny at all. And yet people are just wheeling it out like it's the truth, Torah from Sinai, you know, that you have to believe every word of this. It's just really, really crazy how all of that gets done. Unfortunately, in the process, another IDF soldier was killed in a battle in northern Gaza. He was killed by sniper fire when he was on guard duty. And apparently the terrorist who shot him then escaped and fled, which brings the total number of IDF soldiers who have been killed since the start of the war to 912. The most recent casualty, unfortunately, is Staff Sergeant Chalachu Shimon Demalash. He was a Nahal Brigade fighter. And our hearts and our sympathy goes to his family and to his friends and all of those around him, because every life is a world unto itself. And we have lost so many of our worlds. Everyone is extremely painful for us. And especially over the Chagim period, when the family should rather be celebrating positive things, and yet this family now over the period of the holidays will be sitting shiva for a young man whose life was cut down in its prime. And that is a major, major grief, source of grief for us right now. And, you know, the grief that we feel every day just keeps us in a certain situation. It doesn't allow us to get beyond this. And I've said a few times, we really need this war to end. We need to be able to grieve as a community, as and individuals, without having fires to fight constantly. And we need to somehow pick ourselves up and to be able to recover from this. And unfortunately, until we get to the moment that our hostages are released, 720 days have now passed since our hostages were taken captive, until our hostages are released, until the war is over, we're not really going to be able to grieve properly, to really put our focus into thinking about what has been lost. Right now, we're still fighting the battles, and we have to keep our eye focused on that.
And we don't have a lot of time, but I just do want to ask you very quickly about Netanyahu traveling to New York to the UN. What can we expect to hear? What can we expect when he speaks?
Well, the Prime Minister traveled last night after the end of Rosh Hashanah, already towards New York. He will be presenting to the United Nations General Assembly sometime during the day tomorrow. I expect that will be one of the very first presentations. I haven't managed to see the agenda for the order of the day tomorrow, but I'm expecting that it will be sometime around 4 to 5 p.m. Israeli time when the session gets underway, because we would prefer prefer that to be, and I'm sure that the Prime Minister's offices are trying to arrange for it to be before the onset of Shabbat in Israel and elsewhere around the world, hopefully in South Africa too, for those people who wish to tune in and to watch it. I am sure that the Prime Minister will give a very heartfelt and convincing presentation, as he usually does. This is a moment that he very much enjoys, standing on the stage in the UN and speaking. He's very convincing. He has the gift of the gab. He certainly knows what he's going to say, and he's very good at presenting Israel's case at the United Nations. Unfortunately, the United Nations is not a great place for influencing any public opinion. We've seen, for example, President Trump, who made his presentation. Those who wish to be well entertained for approximately an hour should certainly try to download the video of President Trump making his speech to the United Nations. Unfortunately, many of these discussions and the whole point about the two-state solution, which has been discussed at length during the United Nations session, much of that was done over Rosh Hashanah, over the Chag, when Israel couldn't participate and wouldn't participate. And so it seems a little kind of strange that a lot of this is being done out of the sight of Israel. But we do understand that the Prime Minister will present tomorrow, for whatever it's worth. He is also due to meet President Trump, we understand, on Monday after the weekend. So that's another thing. And then he will travel back on Tuesday before Yom Kippur. So those who are interested in watching the Prime Minister's presentation, look out for it tomorrow afternoon sometime. I hope it'll be before Shabbat. It'll be interesting to see what he says, but I think we more or less know what it's going to be about.
Anthony Rock, thank you as always, and I wish you a Shabbat Shalom and a great weekend. We'll catch you on Monday morning, 7:45, for the Israel Report.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.